It's Wednesday, March 13th, 2019, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, Facebook's pivot to privacy. Mark Zuckerberg lays out his vision to retool communication from one-to-many back to one-to-one. It's an attempt to reestablish trust among users. Too little, too late? I'll ask Mike and Ernest. An Arkansas newspaper owner and publisher filed a federal lawsuit against that state's government, claiming its law requiring a loyalty pledge to the state of Israel is a violation of the First Amendment. We'll get into the sum of the nuts and bolts of his argument. And a wife tracking app in Saudi Arabia. To many in the West, it sounds horrific, but Apple and Google say they're not pulling it from their app stores. And we'll tell you why. There's a lot that we'll also hopefully get to as well before our half hour is up. But let's start with the interview. By now, you've seen it, or excerpts of it, or parodies of it. Gail King, or should I say, Jail King, and R. Kelly. It was a bona fide master class in the art of the interview. Take a listen to this.
30 years of my career! Y'all trying to kill me! You killing me, man! This is not about music! I'm trying to have a relationship with my kids, and I can't do it! Y'all just don't want to believe the truth! You don't want to believe it!
At this point, we briefly pause the interview to give Kelly a moment. His publicist helped calm him down.
I hope this camera keep going.
No, we're going to let the camera keep
true. Rolling. This is not true. This doesn't even make sense. Why would I hold all these women? Their mothers and fathers told me, we're going to destroy your career.
But Kelly's emotions remained raw. Robert.
It's real girls out there missing. It's real young girls out there being abducted, being raped. Okay? They really are on chains. They really do have chains on their wrists, and they can't get out.
Robert,
and they're ending up buried in debt.
Robert, we have to have a conversation.
This is
really,
not me.
I don't want you just ranting at the camera.
I think I came here for them to hear me talk.
But
I need help.
What kind of help?
This is the kind of help I need.
Yes, what kind of help?
I need somebody to help me not have a big heart. Because my heart is so big, people betray me, and I keep forgiving them.
You sound like you're playing the victim here. You sound like R. Kelly, you do. When I listen to you,
I'm just
it does
telling
sound
the
like
truth.
You're playing the victim
I'm
card.
Just telling the truth. And the reason I'm emotional,
Robert,
and I apologize for that, is because this is the first time I was able to say
speak.
Something. Yeah. I've said nothing.
Well, you may not have seen was the body language that Gail King showed throughout the entire interview. She was patient. She was empathetic. She gave him a chance to speak, but she also wasn't about to have any of the antics that he showed. And she wasn't about to let him play the victim. Maybe even better, though, was the cold open on Saturday Night Live. Take a listen to this.
Robert, you've been combative, defensive, and completely unhinged. But somehow you expect us to believe you are completely innocent.
That would be ideal, yes. And now I humbly await your decision, Miss Jail King.
What? My name is Gail King with a G.
So you're not the Jail King? Then what I'm doing here?
Boy, you are not right.
So you think I made things worse?
Yes, you definitely made them worse.
Scale of 1 to 10. How much worse?
13.
And what he then says next, he goes, oh, so that's better than 10. We watched both part of the clip itself from the interview, the parody. The part that I can't seem to get over was that the publicist, R. Kelly's crisis management specialist, thinks that this was a positive outcome.
Or he says that. I mean, he's being paid by R. Kelly. True. And it was R. Kelly, or the publicist, that approached Gail King and CBS about doing the interview, not the other way around. So a part of his ranting might have been for the cameras and deliberately set up. Part of it might have been he just went off once he got going.
But if it was deliberately set up, think about this. One of the things he's trying to defend against is to say that he's not abusing women. He's not abusing black women. Yet he's standing over Gail King. The optics are not good.
The optics were horrible. I mean, it was... I mean, to say he came unhinged, I mean, that's an understatement. That's a huge understatement. And for his publicist to come back and say that this actually helped him, I don't see in any way possible this helped him. He may have even said some things during all of that ranting that is probably going to be used against him once this case makes it to court. It was just stunning to see the way he reacted. But I think that you were right in terms of what Gayle King did. I mean, she kept coming back at him and saying, okay, I want to have a conversation. You've had your opportunity to rant and to do all these things, but let's talk about what's really going on here in terms of what you've been accused of. And now you have an opportunity to talk about that and not all these other things. And he really didn't take an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people focused rightly on how calm she was with this man hulking over her and yelling at her. And that was good. Mm-hmm. But I don't normally think of Gayle King when you say great interviewers or great journalists who do interviews. Mm-hmm. But what she did was pretty classic. I mean, she wasn't confrontational, but she was really well prepared. So she asks him whether or not, you know, these people are all lying, these women. Right. Yeah, well, they're lying. Then he names the women and says, why would all of these women be complaining? Well, they're just lying. Then she details the allegations they made against him. And so she's building this case, and I think she's doing a classic job of interviewing that I haven't seen her do in the
past. But in doing that, she was also giving him an opportunity.
Yeah.
And instead of him taking that opportunity, which I'm going to assume is what he and his publicist and
intended to do,
he went off script and just started talking about all these other things about, you know, I need people to help me not have a big heart. I mean, how does that answer the question as to whether or not these allegations are true?
By the way, I'll say this was a good week both for Gayle King and for her good friend Oprah Winfrey. She did an interview that followed the airing of the documentary mm-hmm. about Michael Jackson leaving Neverland. And I mean, there are lawsuits and there's all kinds of concerns about what kind of
boycotts against his music. I mean, yeah.
And there were all kinds of troubles that could aimed at Oprah and, as well as the filmmaker and the two men in that film who accused Michael Jackson of sexually abusing them when they were boys. And yet she was there asking tough questions of both sides. She read the entire statement from the Jackson estate and then went on to bring out a bunch of other victims, including, I mean, she herself is acknowledged being a victim of sexual abuse as a child. And it was really effective television. And despite the fact that she was on a high wire, Oprah was, like her friend Gayle, doing some pretty good yeoman's work there in interviewing people.
Yeah.
So going back to Gayle for a second and what was going on in that interview with R. Kelly, Mike, you had mentioned that you thought so much of the success of that interaction, or lack of success on R. Kelly's part, was because of her preparation and the really good job she had done in that. What if it wasn't Gayle King sitting in that chair? What if it was a man? What if it was someone of a different race? How might either of those factors come into the perception of how R. Kelly came off?
I mean, you know, I think Ernest, part of it is journalistic preparation,
right.
And just part of it is life preparation.
No, I think it was a combination of both. She wasn't going to lose her cool. I mean, and in some ways, in watching this again on mm-hmm. the clip that we just showed, in looking at it again, I'm wondering whether or not he may have went off prior to sitting in front of the camera. And so she kind of had a glimpse as to what might be coming. I mean, that's a possibility there, too. But regardless of that, you're right. I mean, I think it was, you know, she's dealt with issues like this probably in the past, either as a reporter or maybe
in her personal life.
She wasn't going to be intimidated by him, because she's probably been in situations where men have stood up and tried to stand over her and intimidate her with their presence. And so she's like, that's not going to do it. Yeah. I'm here to conduct an interview. I'm here on a mission, and I'm going to stick to the mission. And I think she was very good in doing that.
Okay. The talk coming out of Washington, D.C. in the House of Representatives and its vote on a resolution to condemn anti-Semitism has drawn a lot of discussion about whether support for the state of Israel and anti-Semitism are one and the same. It's a thorny subject and one that we're not going to solve here in just a few minutes' time. But I do want to bring up something that's going on in Arkansas that's kind of related to this. Arkansas is one of 28 states that has an anti-BDS law. That means that in order to contract with with the state, businesses need to pledge not to support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. That's a campaign that promotes financial boycotts against the state of Israel until it pulls out of occupied territories and grants full equality for Arab Palestinians. When the publisher of the Arkansas Times received notices from the state of Arkansas telling him that he had to sign a pledge not to boycott Israel in order to continue to receive state contracts, he ignored them. And it turned out that meant losing one of his biggest advertisers, the University of Arkansas Pulaski Technical College. Here he is in an interview with Vice. It aired on HBO.
You say it's unconstitutional. Why?
Well, because it's a violation of freedom of speech. So we're going to let the state, whether it's the federal state or the state of Arkansas, influence a political position of a newspaper in return for money. Okay, is that a good idea?
Foreign policy is largely the purview of the federal government. Why do you feel the need to enact legislation on the state level?
It's more than just the boundaries and the land in Israel, right? I believe that it expands to the Jewish people. You know, when we see on a federal level, when they're going to sanction Iran, right, they have the right to do that as a country. I think as a state, we felt like we had the right to make a statement as well.
But you're not sanctioning another country, you're sanctioning your own citizens.
Right, we are. We're sending a message that says, hey, we are not going to stand by in Arkansas and let people take our taxpayer money against something that our overwhelmingly amount of our taxpayers don't believe in. You can choose to boycott Israel and be in Arkansas. We're not taking away your First Amendment freedom of expression at all. Just we're not going to do business with you at that point.
So that last voice that you heard belonged to the legislator who was the sponsor of the bill. The publisher said that his paper is left-leaning. It has never supported a boycott of Israel. It's never supported Israel. What it supported was receiving advertising dollars from a state university that helped keep the business afloat.
Yeah, and arguably, that's unconstitutional, though this lawmaker was trying to make the claim that there's a difference between the freedom to say something and the freedom from the consequences of receiving state money. But I still think it's, at the very least, fundamentally against our notions of the free press and free expression. And so good for this editor for sticking
up. No, I'm glad the editor stuck up for it. I mean, this signing pledges, I mean, that's... I mean, to me, that's going a little overboard. Where do you stop signing? I mean, we talked a lot about the Pledge of Allegiance and athletes, standing up and not kneeling during the Pledge of Allegiance. But then you turn around and you see this where they're saying you must pledge not to
boycott another country.
To boycott another country, or we're not going to allow you to take a contract from the state. And the whole line about, well, overwhelmingly the taxpayers of the state of Arkansas believe in this. Where's the poll? Show me the vote. Because they voted you in office, you believe that you have the right to enact laws like this. I mean, that's the problem I have with, is that you enact laws claiming that these laws are supported by all the people, when in fact it's just probably a small majority.
At least by a majority of the state legislature in Arkansas. Yeah. It looked like you were about to say something.
No, and also it really, there are protections against minorities and their expression for a reason in our country. And I think this could play back to the whole situation playing out in Washington too. We can agree that, Representative Omar played to some anti-Semitic tropes in what she said, but she's perfectly capable and allowed in this country to be able to argue against policies of the Israeli government and American politicians who support those policies.
Yeah, I mean, we do the same thing when you talk about Iran, when you talk about Russia, when you talk about China. You see that over and over again, but it just seems to me that when the conversation turns to a very strong ally, say Israel or heck, you could say Great Britain, all of a sudden it's, wait a minute, hands off on that one. You're going to get your hands slapped on that. I mean, that's an issue that really needs to be dealt with.
Well, and I will tell you, I was somewhat motivated yesterday as I was beginning to write the script for our show and saw that Arkansas is one of 28. I wondered about Missouri.
It's not yet.
There was an anti-BDS law that was proposed. It was a bill that was proposed last spring that did not make it out of the legislative session. Chris Wallace called it a short-sighted decision. The Democratic National Committee's plan to keep Fox News Channel out of all 12 of the presidential primary debates scheduled for the next year. I can't help but agree with him here. In his words, he's saying that they would have had a little bit of a man-bites-dog quality, maybe an opportunity to bring some different perspectives from those candidates or to have them answer to an audience that perhaps they weren't necessarily targeting earlier, who maybe they might win some people over.
I mean, I tend to agree from a pragmatic assessment mm-hmm. that Chris Wallace is right. I mean, Fox News does reach voters that whoever the Democratic candidate ends up being against Donald Trump needs to be able to reach. On the other hand, I can understand from the party's perspective why they would say, I mean, it's clear that Fox News Channel as an entity is a wholly owned subsidiary of the White House or vice versa. I'm not sure which way it is. And even though you've got great journalists working there at Fox News, Chris Wallace is one of them. There are others. They're completely overwhelmed by at both the top management level and by the opinion hosts who are on that show.
I mean, I'd have to agree with you on that. When I saw this, I really wasn't surprised. Because, I mean, if you look at, and even on this show, we've talked about it over and over again, is that, you know, that Fox, when you go back to the Bush years and both Bush 1 and Bush 2, I mean, you know, Fox sort of leaned in that direction, but I have never seen a network news organization that is as connected to and is sort of utilized by a sitting president the way Fox News is right now. I mean, not only we're talking about people in the administration going back and forth between Fox News and the administration, but we're talking about day after day after day of them actually trumpeting things that come directly from the White House.
Nice pun.
I will say, though,
I don't know if you caught that.
I did catch that.
Well, there were a plethora of Republican presidential candidates last time around. You know, the Republican Party was not trying to keep MSNBC or CNN from carrying debates. On the other hand, those networks really wanted to do them, too, because there was a certain candidate who was ratings gold.
And so, yeah.
Continued to give them the audience. Well, for people who are joining us a little bit late into the program, I'd like to thank you for being here with us for Views of the News. I'm Amy Simons. I'm here with my colleagues again, just to go ahead and reintroduce ourselves, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. Our next topic is perfectly timed for the switch to daylight savings time. It's Sunshine Week. This is a week where investigative journalism and the idea of uncovering things that people don't want us to know or to see, that we celebrate that as journalists.
Freedom of expression is more important, perhaps, than it's been in a long time, just because of the attacks on it from our current administration, from people on social media, from dictators around the world. But it's also imperiled in ways that it hasn't been in a long time because of presidents attacking the media as enemies of the people, because of the business model falling apart for newspapers especially. So it's a good time to be thinking about why freedom of the press and freedom of expression are really important.
And I think as we move toward the 2020 presidential elections, become really important because, as we just got to talking about with Fox News, you have this sort of this sort of differences of opinion and differences of thought, but also differences in the way in which the events are being covered by some news organizations as opposed to others.
Okay. Well, one thing that the internet taught me today, it's Thank a Journalist Day, so thank you to both of you. Last Wednesday, another blog post from Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg with his vision for the future of how the company and people will engage within their social networks on platforms owned by Facebook. The message was one that few people expected. It's a pivot to privacy. It's rooted in six pillars: private interactions, encryption, reducing permanence, safety, secure data storage, and interoperability. He wants to be able to have you seamlessly go from one platform to another. Yep. Some of these are self-explanatory. Reducing permanence, it means bringing more of the ephemeral content that we've seen with the popularity of Instagram stories. End-to-end encryption, okay, that's been one of the most popular aspects of WhatsApp. What about some of these others, though?
Well, I mean, can I add one, by
Please
the way?
Do.
Can I add a seventh? Reputation and damage control?
Yeah.
Could I have another butt covering? Could I add another one, trying to avoid regulation?
Yeah.
But, I mean, Mark Zuckerberg is not
those
stupid.
Those are the unstated pillars.
The people around him are not stupid either. I mean, they're following trends. I mean, some of these trends, I mean, they basically stole stories from Snapchat, a platform that's, you know,
and it's working for them.
It's working
and
for
Kylie
them.
And Kylie Jenner helped them kind of sort of kill it.
WhatsApp, you know,
meaning
makes,
Snapchat.
Yeah. It's yeah. working. Facebook Marketplace is an area that's really expanded. Mm-hmm. The news feed, you know, I mean, they still generate a lot of advertising right. revenue from it. Don't know exactly how they plan to replace it. But all of this makes sense if you're thinking, one, we follow the trends. Two, we have a serious damage to our reputation that we have to overcome with, you know, Analytica, Cambridge Analytica, and all of the problems there. They also have problems with, you know, just data privacy in general. And so I can see why they're moving in that, or at least saying they're moving in that direction. It also protects them in some ways if people continue to use their platforms for hate speech or for right. telling falsehoods and fake news, because now you can hide behind encryption and privacy and you can't really track it back to right. Facebook.
And if you look at that word that you had a problem with,
interoperability.
Yeah, I'm having problems with it as well. I mean,
it's much easier to read than it is to say.
Can we all say WeChat? You know, because I think that's where they like to, where Mark Zuckerberg would like
they
to go.
They wish they could be.
I mean, they wish they could be WeChat. And in some of this, you see that WeChat, the fact that you can use WhatsApp and all the others
and
together.
For our audience that may not be familiar with WeChat, the three of us are because of the amount of time that we've spent in China. WeChat is a singular app that when I describe it to other people, it's almost like saying every app that exists on your phone today wrapped up into one. Right. And because Facebook and WhatsApp and Instagram and Snapchat and Twitter and all of the platforms people here are used to using aren't allowed to be used in China because of the great firewall put up by its government, WeChat is the primary social network there, and it operates very differently than a lot of the platforms we're used to here, in that most of the communication is done user to user, and that there has to be a reciprocal relationship in order for content to exchange between users. It's much more private.
And that's sort of what he's talking about right here. And I think that's where he wants to go, with the added addition of, you know, you're trying to do it in somewhat of a capitalist environment. And that's going to be the interesting part.
Which is also interesting because of how he has also been trying to kind of work the Chinese government to try to break down some of those restrictions on his platforms. Right.
I wonder, though, I'm just... in terms of the news media, some news organizations have relied on, maybe too much, on Facebook as a platform to generate traffic. Is this a problem or an opportunity if Facebook pivots in this direction away from public news feeds and groups? It could be an opportunity for the right organization if they can come up with the right strategy.
Which could be, again, another reason for us to be looking more seriously at the functionalities of WeChat. The use and popularity of different apps in different parts of the world, it isn't anything new. Different needs among different populations, different practices, different laws, they all result in the needs for different software. That's why Apple and Google say they're not giving in to pressure from several human rights groups and U.S. lawmakers who say they should pull an app called Absher from its app stores because of what it does. It allows husbands to track their wives' comings and goings in Saudi Arabia. The answer is simple. It's an app that provides a service that fills a need for something that's completely legal in that country. And for that reason, Apple and Google aren't going to pull it off the marketplace.
Okay, that's a that's a pretty good reason if you're living in Saudi Arabia, I guess, and you are okay with that. But when you start looking at it from outside of Saudi Arabia in particular, from here, it's like, whoa, wait a minute. This is going to create problems for Apple and for others, because you could have a public backlash here. How do you deal with that?
I understand that it's more complicated than it sounds from the headline. There was a piece you got on our Links blog that talks about even some Saudi feminists say, well, it's better than the alternative. But I got to say, I mean, that doesn't make it right.
That doesn't make it right.
I mean, imagine in France, for example, it's the law that you cannot wear ostensibly religious symbolism or clothing in public, designed to ban Muslim women from wearing the burqa or hijab or other things. Would it be okay then to say, well, we're going to have an app that's going to surreptitiously turn on a woman's camera. It's going to take a picture of her if she's wearing a burqa, and it's going to use GPS to call the police on her. I don't think we would think that was okay. Or it's legal in many, unfortunately, many countries for female genital mutilation. Are we going to say, well, we've got an app that's a healthcare app, yeah, but it's also going to somehow track a young woman, and if she's trying to get away from her family taking her to have this procedure done, well, we're going to track her down. You cannot use that as an excuse for not criticizing what is clearly a violation, yeah, of someone's personal
and
rights.
And who's to say that this can't be used somewhere else? I mean, who's actually policing this?
Download it in Saudi Arabia, use it elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guarantee you that there's probably somebody out there trying to figure out how to make it happen.
Same way that when we're in China, we use VPN to use some of those apps that may not be permitted by the government there.
Yep.
Before we go, a little something happier to brighten the mood. I saw something on a site called The Ringer that I wanted to share with you and that I wanted to ask the two of you about because it made me laugh. It's an attempt to narrow down the internet's happiest day of the decade. I can't believe in March we have our first look back at the 20-teens, but our first list in retrospective as the decade starts to come to a close. The happiest day of the 20-teens on the internet was...
I forgot.
Okay, very good.
Sorry. So, I know what a couple of them were. I don't know what the happiest day
well,
was.
So what
Beyonce's
would be,
birthday, was that the one? Or, I don't know.
I don't know. What would be yours, though, if you had to pick your happiest day on the internet?
Well, from the 20-teens, I think it might be some of these really cool toddler entertainment videos like Baby Shark. I mean, how many grandkids?
Oh, God.
There you go.
I love Baby Shark.
Doopy doop.
But if it were
Thanks, Mike.
I'll take you back to the 1990s.
Okay.
So how about...
Now we have the dancing baby from Ally McBeal.
No. Okay. How about when the University of Illinois released Mosaic, the first browser available to, mm-hmm, the public? Or how about 1997 in September when Google was first available before we had all the tracking and the advertising, but just, yeah, suddenly the world's information was, yeah, available for us to search. Those were pretty cool days.
Yeah. Trying to remember.
Ernest can't come up with one now because he's singing Baby Shark.
Yeah, Baby Shark is going through my head. Oh, yeah, yeah. I heard it this past weekend, trust me. But, I mean, I guess, you know, Netscape, maybe?
Netscape was my first browser. That was the first one I really liked.
That's the one I guess I would look at is, you know, the whole Netscape craze, which, you know, unless you were in that time period, you would have no idea what that was all about.
I also loved the, what color is this dress? I'm sorry.
That was going to be mine, actually, was is it black and black and blue or white and gold?
Yeah.
What color was the dress? Well, we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us and singing Baby Shark. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about on our program today under the links on our links blog. You can find that under the programs tab and the podcast tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at views on KBIA. And these are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week and more. And a reminder that today marks the end of KBIA's spring membership drive. If you've been listening in the mornings, you've heard Mike and me asking you to support the programming you hear on KBIA. If you didn't get a chance to give us a call during the day, you can still get it in under the wire. Make your pledge right now online at kbia.org. Just click the red donate button in the upper right-hand corner, and you'll qualify for all of the same thank you gifts you'd get over the phone. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan, Aaron Hay for handling the audio, Tim Pilcher for our theme music. I'm Amy Simons. We'll see you next week.